Good afternoon. It is a Monday, kicking off your work week here, February the 12th. 12 minutes past the hour, you're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears with you along for the ride. Hope you're having a good day. How can you not with this sunny weather after the cold, bleak, windy, snowy, icy weather we've had over the last couple weeks? The sun is shining today, and it is not bad temperature-wise, and apparently that's going to stick around for a little bit, so we're all happy about that. Today on the program, we have to go back to Washington, D.C., politics in general, because we've said it a million times, it is never dull in Washington, D.C., or in politics anymore, ever. Ohio politics is this governor's race is unbelievable. What our governor is doing, what the president's doing, one person to go to, and I'm also glad to announce this. She was a panelist on the long-running television series The McLaughlin Group, which is back up and running. You can watch those episodes on YouTube. And hopefully that will grow. I'm so glad to see that that is back. She also writes for the Daily Beast. She's been on this program many times. We're always glad to welcome her back. She fills us in on what's going on. Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for putting in a plug for the new McLaughlin Group, which is just like the old McLaughlin Group, except we don't have John with us anymore, but we're glad to be up and running.
Yeah, first of the year, that started up again. I was watching some episodes over the weekend, and it's a great show. It's very important, I think, to have that back.
Great. Thank you so much, Scott.
Absolutely. President Trump, right now, is laying out his infrastructure plan. We've been talking about memos, things going on in the White House, people leaving, people coming. Why all this news all of a sudden?
Because it's Donald Trump, and he's a master of disruption and distraction. And you would think that after the State of the Union that he would be talking about his tax plan, which passed the Congress and which he signed, and that he would be traveling the country perhaps to promote his next big initiative, which is the infrastructure proposal. But instead, he's gotten waylaid by jumping into a fight over the House Intelligence Committee and competing memos from the Republicans on the committee and the Democrats on the committee. And he green-lighted the Republican memo to much fanfare 2 weeks ago. And he's now saying that the Democratic memo has to go through more vetting, that it compromises sources, something that he completely overlooked with the Republican memo, even going against the considered opinion of his own Justice Department. So he's at war with his Justice Department, and then, of course, the allegations of spousal abuse surfaced against top White House aide. And Rob Porter, he's now left his position as staff secretary, but the president's comments wishing him well, saying hopes he has a great career, while making no mention of the two ex-wives who claimed he abused them, including one who furnished a picture of herself with a black eye, and a recent girlfriend who has not yet been named, who went to the White House and said that she had the same difficulties with him. So now the Me Too movement is back in the headlines, and Steve Bannon, the former White House strategic advisor, has apparently said that he thinks the power of the Me Too movement could bring down Donald Trump. So I don't know if that's the case, but it's an interesting observation that the president, who was elected despite that access videotape and despite actually dozens of women making claims against him, seems to be weathering all of that. But this former top advisor saying, maybe not, that maybe that's what ultimately takes him down. So a lot to consider, a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. 2 weeks ago, a little over 2 weeks ago now, this memo comes out. What was it supposed to do, and what was the purpose? I mean, did it do anything?
No. Everybody was claiming that it was such a blockbuster. The Republicans were claiming it would vindicate the president of any claims of collusion, and Democrats were saying that sources and methods could be compromised, people could die, and it reveal anything that wasn't mostly in the public before. I think the biggest new thing it brought to the table was the allegation on the Republican side that the FBI had misled the judge in the FISA court, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It's a secret court. The judges are appointed by Chief Justice John Roberts, so it's not like it's a liberal cabal. The claim was that the judge that made the decision to allow a surveillance of Carter Page, a Trump advisor during the campaign and a kind of an oil and gas executive who'd lived in Moscow and who had been on the FBI's radar since 2013 or 2014, because the Russians had actively tried to recruit him as a spy. And so the FISA court authorized the continuation of surveillance of Carter Page, and somehow the Republicans see that as a plot by Hillary Clinton and the Democrats to undermine Donald Trump. You have to really be a fevered conspiracy theorist to buy what the Republicans were saying.
What is supposed to be in this Democratic memo?
It's reported to be a pushback of the Republican memo. So I imagine it will lay out in some detail how this dossier, which was put together by a former British intelligence agent, Christopher Steele, who was initially engaged by a media organization that was on the right, and I believe Ted Cruz's campaign may have had some connection with it, but it's typical opposition research that candidates do on themselves and others, and the opposition research started on the Republican side during the 2016 primary about Donald Trump, and then when the Republicans dropped it, Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democrats took it up. But in the course of putting together this dossier about Trump's connections to Russia and his attempts to do business there, Christopher Steele, the highly regarded former MI6 intel agent, became so alarmed about Russian efforts to tilt the election towards Trump and to get involved in our electoral process that he actually went to the FBI with his material, and he had a pre-existing relationship with the FBI, so they know who he is and they value his work. And so there was some back and forth there, and Steele also talked to some reporters in this country. So I imagine the Democratic memo will spell all that out as to the origins of the dossier, and then point out that the dossier was not the only information that the FBI had about possibly improper contacts between Trump officials and Russia. If they had already been working on other contacts that they had uncovered. So I imagine that's what it will explain. But it is still classified, so we don't really know exactly what's in it. But if it has the kind of impact the Republican memo had, it will do nothing to fully answer any questions or end the Russia probe. I think the Russia probe is ongoing, and Robert Mueller is a very careful investigator, and I don't see any end in sight, at least not yet.
This dossier, this was leaked out many, many months ago, and all the details of it have not been put on radio and television, but it was all on a website at one point, and several websites. But why are we to believe that maybe some of the stuff in here was made up? What would be Steele's reason for making it up or getting bad facts? Why is some of that not to be believed?
Oh, I don't think Steele would have any motive to make things up, but Steele did not. He had contacts in Moscow. I'm not sure he actually traveled to Moscow, but he had contacts of long standing because he had done a lot of work of this nature. And so, you know, he's only as good as his contacts. And he basically has been very clear about how some aspects of the dossier have been proved and others haven't. And the most scurrilous parts, there's, you know, some suggestion that maybe there's an audio or a videotape that exists and that Donald Trump worries and that he might not know whether that exists or not. But the puzzle we're trying to ask is why Donald Trump and President Trump is so solicitous of the Russians as though they have something on him. I think that's the puzzle that everybody is looking for the answer to.
Wouldn't you think that people working in the White House who came after this, like Kelly and other people in there who weren't a part of the campaign, Mattis, wouldn't those people, aren't they curious about this too, even if they like President Trump? And isn't President Trump aware that this looks strange?
Well, if you're working in the administration today, you fine if you're curious, but you're not going to be asking very many questions because everybody's all lawyered up now. And whatever you say or whatever you consult about, you know, could have legal ramifications. So I don't think there are any, soul-searching conversations between his top aides and the president saying, you know, trying to get to the bottom of the behavior. Everybody seems to be trying to buy his line, which is that there's no collusion. He says that repeatedly. But even if there is no collusion, the steps he has taken, beginning with the firing of the first FBI director, James Comey, sure look like he's trying to impede the investigation. And he even said to Lester Holt on the NBC Evening News that he wanted to move Comey aside because of the Russia investigation. So he's been pretty blunt about that. And obstruction of justice is a crime, even if there's no underlying crime. So people around him are, I'm sure, you know, quite careful about what they say for fear that they're going to venture into territory that could hold them, you know, legally culpable in some way. And everybody's already got lawyers, and lawyers are expensive. So I think it's called time in the White House. At one point, when the president moved aside his sort of personal lawyers and brought in Ty Cobb, a very respected, you know, sort of uber lawyer here in Washington, brought him into the White House, the idea was that they could kind of cordon off the Russian investigation and have you know, the lawyers and a spokesman handle that so that the rest of the White House could go on and do their business. That was the model that Bill Clinton used, the Clinton administration. They brought in Lanny Davis, a lawyer and a very loyal Clinton person, and he had a staff, and they dealt with reporters on the Whitewater / Monica Lewinsky investigation while the president was able to conduct business with the rest of the West Wing. Trump tried to do that, but it doesn't seem to have succeeded. The lines are very blurred between what the White House is doing on immigration or policy fights, and he kind of jumps into it all the time with a tweet that reminds everybody that he doesn't really like the Russia investigation.
You know, Eleanor, here's something I don't understand. We have a lot of people on, and this is a big conversation right now, but even people who tend to be toward the progressive side and the people who don't like Donald Trump, they always say this. They say, well, we're not going to redo the election. Hillary Clinton's not going to be president. Donald Trump will resign. He won't go to prison. Somebody will pardon him. And he will probably pardon his family if he got the chance. So even if Mueller's investigation does show this collusion, does show, I heard last week from Dr. Ron Feynman, who's a author and political scientist, that they're even looking into voting machine hacking. Even if it shows any of this, what does this do besides put Donald Trump back in Trump Tower?
Well, you know, you can write a number of scenarios. I don't think we really know how this is going to spin out. I mean, I think the Democrats have to proceed on the assumption that he's going to run for re-election in 2020, and they need to get their message in order, that they have a compelling economic message that can speak to, you know, both the left and the working class whites who defected for Trump. You know, everybody's got the same economic interest, so that shouldn't really be that hard. But I think Democrats can't count on impeachment proceedings. They'd have to win the House back first, and it looks like they have a good chance, but it's not certain. And then he could well be exonerated, or I wouldn't say exonerated, not convicted in the Senate. Bill Clinton was not convicted in the Senate. It takes 2/3 of the Senate. Hard to see that happening. You know, maybe President Trump will just get sick of the whole thing and decide to walk away. That's possible. But, you know, I think we have to wait and see what Mr. Mueller comes up with. Well, and whether it matters to the Republican Party. They've shedded so many of their allegedly core beliefs, the balancing the budget, you know, don't raise the deficit, we believe in free trade. They've flipped on everything that they once stood for. So they may circle the wagons and protect him. And then Democrats will have to see if the resistance can really turn an emotional movement into a movement that gets votes. I mean, they've done it in Virginia, they've done it in Alabama, they've done it for a couple of seats in New Jersey, and I think it was Minnesota. So, but that's, you can't make assumptions that, oh, you know, Mueller's going to lay an egg and that won't get him out, or so what matters if we get him back to Trump Tower? Then you've got Pence in there, and progressives don't like Pence either. Better to have a wounded lion. It's all great conversation, but you have to deal with the facts that are in front of you immediately. And right now, the president's poll ratings have actually gone up a bit. He's, I think, going through the 40% threshold. It's still very low poll numbers, but he has not lost his base of support. He did push through a huge tax cut. I think it will have negative effects, actually, on the economy in the end of it, in the end. And the stock market jitters are telling us that people are afraid about rising interest rates and all that. But, he's got some high cards. And, you know, so Democrats can't just get all wrapped up in the palace intrigue and think that he's a goner. He may not be.
And I think that's maybe the point, because I think as far as collusion goes, there could be a case to be made for that already with his son taking the meeting with the Russians. Obstruction of justice, well, he kind of admitted that to Lester Holt when he fired Comey.
Right.
So we really don't need Mueller for that one. And I think in the end, anything short of changing votes in voting machines, which apparently could have happened, I don't know. I assume he's investigating that. I don't know. It's a strange dynamic, because I that's what I hear from most of the progressive group, is that we think there's something there. There's a lot of smoke there. But even if there is, what does it really do? Even if he does leave, Nixon didn't go to prison. Nixon wasn't put on trial. Clinton really was, he was impeached, but he wasn't removed. In the end, what does it do?
Well, if there's a change of leadership, that does a lot. I don't know that we necessarily have to have, revenge and have his, head on a poker in Lafayette Park. I think how much you may disdain and dislike him, he is a president, and maybe a former president before he'd like. And the other thing that that Mueller could be looking for is the old Watergate line, follow the money, money laundering. Money laundering is a crime. And the properties that changed hands and were, sold to Russian oligarchs, or Russian money got involved. I mean, I think that is a promising line of inquiry. Deutsche Bank has turned over its records to Mueller. That was not the only bank that would loan Trump any money after all his bankruptcies and failed businesses in the 80s and the 90s. He was pretty desperate for money. So I think that's another promising line of inquiry. And in terms of changing votes, I'm not so sure that the Trump campaign necessarily did that, but they may have directed some Russian folks to as to which states they might want to see if they could hack into. And information has emerged that they were in 31 states. And it's not so much what they did once they got there, it's that they were in there at all. And, that is the most successful semi-covert operation to invade our electoral process. And they're not walking away from it. So I imagine that's continuing. And there are now many discussions about how we can strengthen our voting system. Every state does it differently. So you can get in there, you change a few people's middle names, a number and an address, and all of a sudden lots of people can't vote. So there are things they could do, and whether the Trump campaign was directly involved in advising or any of that would be a smoking gun. But if they weren't, it still should shock us that the Russians were able to destabilize our election to the extent that they did.
I just think the two points in this whole thing that are very important is that if they did get into the machines, as you say, to do anything on election day, that I don't think the country's going to sit well with that one. Because even what I hear from Republicans are people who hate Hillary Clinton, is they say, well, but they didn't change any votes. Well, if we find out that they did, I think that becomes a bigger conundrum, and I think that that's just not up to the old line of secession. Because one thing I always remember about Nixon is, I don't remember who said it, but one person said if they could ask Nixon one thing, they would say, why did you try to bug Democratic headquarters? The Democrats didn't have a chance to win that election, even if you hadn't. So, but this time, that's something different. And the other thing is, it's my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong about this, that if it does come down to money laundering or something like that, even if Trump would get a pardon if he left office, he can still be tried in New York. That there are some different laws there. Somebody had said that. I don't know. It's very confusing.
No, actually, it's not that confusing. I think Robert Mueller has made sure that some of his material is in the possession of the New York State officials, and that if he were shut down in his investigation, they would have sufficient materials to proceed on the state level. So people are trying to take protective measures in case Trump, as the investigation moves closer and closer, and he gets more desperate to shut it down, to make sure that the information is not lost and that it can proceed. So there haven't really been any leaks out of the Mueller operation. I mean, and he's a very careful investigator. He's a registered Republican, even though President tries to make it sound like it's a cabal of Democrats who were pining over Hillary Clinton that are after him. These are apolitical, really, investigators. They're doing their job, and they're following the money. And if the president refuses to cooperate and give testimony, he could be subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury. And if he refused to do that, could be headed to the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court basically has ruled no man is above the law, and that during the Clinton administration, that opened up Clinton, you know, to lawsuits and the situation he found himself in. It's hard to imagine the Supreme Court would do the reverse, although it is a 5-4 conservative edge in the court. But I imagine President Trump will be watching, if it should come to that, he'll be watching what Neil Gorsuch does, his appointee, because Gorsuch spoke out at one point. He didn't like some of the president's language about the judge in Arizona who was ruling on a case, and Trump said he didn't think he could be fair because he was Hispanic heritage. And I think Gorsuch said something like, he was quoted saying that was unfortunate. And according to the Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, the president wondered if he could withdraw the nomination of Gorsuch at that point, because he'd rather appoint somebody who would be loyal to him and somebody he knew. It's easy to excuse some of the president's outbursts as coming from someone who's not that familiar with how government works, but I don't think Trump really cares about how government works. I mean, he responds emotionally and would like to basically be an authoritarian figure to the extent that he can get away with it.
I guess what I mean by confusing is that if Mueller's investigation comes back that it has something to do with those taxes, something to do with money laundering, something to do with dealings financially with Russia, even if the Republicans rally around him and don't start impeachment proceedings, it's my understanding the Attorney General in New York, who I don't think would have any trouble bringing charges against the president, that would happen. And that could end badly for him.
Right, yeah. So, he's got legal problems, and he's going to have a lot of legal bills, too. So that it's going to be interesting to tote up how much he's going to have to pay in legal bills. Although that's been part of his MO throughout his career. He's been sued, and he's sued, you know, I want to say hundreds of times. He's very litigious. And in New York, he was, for the most part, successful. He's now playing in a different league. And he has been caught, according to the reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post. He will occasionally say, "Where's my Roy Cohn?" He really misses the Roy Cohn figure, who was something of a mentor to him. Cohn represented Joe McCarthy in the 50s and was a kind of a ruthless lawyer. Trump admires that. And Cohn's motto was, if somebody hits you with something, you hit them back twice as hard. Never apologize. And, you know, that's the line that Trump follows as well.
Tell me about Joe Kennedy. He gave the Democratic response to the State of the Union. Is this young Kennedy a contender for the nomination in 2020?
I think Joe Kennedy is the real deal, but I don't think he's contending for 2020. And I think that's one of the reasons that Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader in the House, chose him to give the response, because so many Democrats are looking at 2020 and he's one that isn't. He's got lots of time, and I think that he feels like he needs to establish his bona fides first. He's young. I think he's still in his 30s. And he is the grandson of Robert F. Kennedy, and he has a twin, and they're both, you know, Stanford graduates and have done very well. And Joe Kennedy was Attorney General in Massachusetts before he ran for the House. So I think he's a player, but not yet.
The whole sexual, I guess, assault case that broke loose in the White House last week that led to a resignation. Is there going to be any more fallout from that?
On the particular case of Rob Porter, I don't know about that. Maybe I think the press is still eager to find out who was the former girlfriend who blew the whistle on him to the White House. And, you know, he had apparently been dating Hope Hicks, and she's the White House communications director, and she's taken some flack for participating in crafting the very positive statements about him initially, you know, basically him saying that the allegations were, you know, vile, and that he was innocent, and the White House officials saying he had done a great job. So I think there's still going to be some fallout from that. But the Me Too movement has now veered into domestic violence, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, those are women who are the most frightened about coming forward and fearful of the repercussions. And I think the beginning of the show, I mentioned that Steve Bannon, of all people, has said that he thinks the Me Too movement could bring down Donald Trump. So the way I interpret that is that it's white suburban women who basically voted more than 50% for Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump won the votes of white women over Hillary Clinton. And those are the women who are now have serious questions about his presidency. You know, if they all turn out, and if women turn out and deliver on the resistance and the anger that they feel, that could deliver a, you know, mortal blow to Trump and his Republican Party here in the midterms. So that's That's how I interpret, you know, the Me Too movement bringing down Trump.
Here in Ohio, we've had a little interesting thing playing out in our governor's race. And our governor goes on television all the time now and disagrees with President Trump, Governor Kasich. But here are some interesting things that have been going on, and we've followed them here on this show and actually had the lieutenant governor on this program, John Kasich's current lieutenant governor. Mary Taylor on. I want to play a few clips here because I think this is interesting when we talk in the realm of John Kasich in Ohio and politics. Mm-hmm. Now, John Kasich's lieutenant governor is Mary Taylor. She was on this. John Kasich has endorsed her for governor. She's running against the Attorney General, Mike DeWine, in the primary. Now, I asked Mary Taylor on this program about the Kasich endorsement, and this is what she said. He did endorse you, as we've said, March 27, 2017. Do you want his endorsement?
Yeah, I am not going to denounce it. I don't think there is any advantage or gain to doing that. It's not personally where I am.
Now, Eleanor, when she says that, now that's Kasich's endorsement. Now, here's something else. I want to play this real quick, too. I asked her, because last week the Republican Party in Ohio endorsed Mike DeWine before the primary is over, if she would support Mike DeWine in the Maine election, her Republican counterpart. This is what she said. Can you see yourself voting for him if you're not the nominee? I know you plan to be the nominee, but if you are not, can you get behind this man who you feel is out of touch?
And I do plan to be the nominee, and I always want to answer that question this way. But look, I think that this is the career politician status quo establishment ticket, and they are out of touch with the voters of the state of Ohio. And at this point, no, I do not see being able to support that ticket.
And one more clip here, and people have to remember, now this is John Kasich's current lieutenant governor, Mary Taylor. I asked her if she thinks Governor Kasich should run for president in 2020, and this is what she said. Yes. At this point, do you think Governor Kasich will run for president?
I have no idea.
Would you bet more toward the yes or no?
Truly, honestly, I have no idea. I really don't.
Do you want him to run?
I have no idea.
Do you want him to run for president?
I don't think that right now that's what this country wants. And so I support President Trump, and looking forward to him continuing the agenda that he has outlined on the important work that they need to get done in Washington.
Eleanor, what do you make of that?
This is a candidate who feels like she has to have the Trump vote to win the primary, and so she's running full on for Trump. And it's kind of bizarre since she's the governing partner to John Kasich, who's been a never-Trumper, the most outspoken opponent of Trump. So she's got a tricky line to walk there. And, everybody's anticipating that John Kasich will likely wage a primary challenge to Trump in 2020.
It's interesting to me because it doesn't look like she's going to win the primary against Mike DeWine, the Attorney General, but she says she will not support him, which I'm assuming means she will not vote for him. That could make for a rough time with us electing a new governor. And I don't know, does John Kasich go back and support Mike DeWine? You know, if Mike DeWine had done
it. I think John Kasich supports the winner of the primary. I don't think he would sit it out. I mean, but her position basically is kind of the Tea Party position. If you don't win, you take your ball and go home. It's typically you fight it out in the primaries, and then the winner is raised arms, and then you go against the opposition. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in the primaries. Bernie Sanders did that kind of reluctantly and not that eagerly, and it hurt Hillary Clinton. And I'm sure I can find many other examples where the loser doesn't fully accept the loss and support the winner, and that generally hurts his or her party in the next step.
In Ohio, where you have Rich Cordray, who now is the front runner on the Democratic side, and you have Dennis Kucinich, who jumped in late, who's not far behind him, when you don't have continuity in the on the Republican side, could this elect a Democrat in Ohio, do you think?
I have a lot of respect for Rich Cordray, because I did some reporting on him when he was here in Washington, and he was the Attorney General beforehand. And Dennis Kucinich, as you know, has a long history in Ohio. In recent years, he's been more of a gadfly in the races that he's gotten into. I don't know what kind of good memories there are in Ohio that go back to when he was the mayor, the boy mayor of Cleveland. And then, of course, he held a congressional seat for a long time and lost it in a redistricting thing where he went head to head with a fellow Democrat. So, I don't think that Dennis Kucinich wants to be a spoiler, but that may well be what he ends up being.
The take on this in the last 2 weeks has been, because Rich Cordray was also on the program last week, and I said, I understand you want to be the nominee, I understand you're the front runner, but if that doesn't happen, will you support the Democrat? He says yes. There doesn't seem to be that problem on the Democratic side. Why so much anger?
Well, Cordray is a team player. He also, did you ask him, he was a multi-time Jeopardy winner, too.
Yes.
Yes, he's a very smart guy, and comes across very, you know, reasonable and understated, but boy, he's tough, and he knows what he's doing. I would never underestimate Rich Cordray.
I just think the circle's kind of interesting, because Kasich has endorsed Taylor. Taylor doesn't want the endorsement, it seems like. She says she won't vote for DeWine. And now Kasich's going to have to endorse DeWine if he does get the nomination, which it looks like he will.
I think Kasich would not have one moment of hesitation in endorsing DeWine. And it's pretty clear that his lieutenant governor doesn't want the anti-Trump taint on her, because that's her base. I mean, if she needs to turn out the Trump voters in Ohio and pull off a surprise against the more establishment candidate. Now, Mike DeWine, I assume he's the son of former Senator DeWine?
Same DeWine.
Yeah. It is the same DeWine.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right.
Yeah, he's in his early 70s. Yeah.
Okay, then that's the one I knew in Washington.
That's
exactly
him.
Okay. Well, it's, you know, he was around in the days of, you know, John Glenn and Metzenbaum, and so he's got a long history in the state. So that's interesting that he's waging a very competitive race.
I think the interesting thing, I think you're right from the point of view that Kasich, I don't think it matters who he endorses, because I think, from his standpoint, because he's not going to be governor and he wants to run for president. But I think Mary Taylor doesn't want the Kasich endorsement, because she thinks it'll hurt her with Trump voters. Will DeWine have that problem? If I take Kasich's, because nobody seems to be clamoring for the governor's endorsement, I guess is what I should say.
Oh, interesting. Okay, and so DeWine is probably happy that he doesn't have the endorsement.
Well, here,
Kasich is probably, I mean, she worked closely with him. It would have looked like a real rebuff if he had not endorsed her. So I don't know how much I would value these endorsements. They're kind of pro forma.
Just for the audience, because this is the short story of what happened, they were both speaking in Claremont County, Mary Taylor, and actually Mike DeWine sent John Husted, who's the Secretary of State, who's running with him, up there for a Republican donor meeting. And Mary Taylor said that one of the donors said, who has Governor Kasich endorsed? And she said, Mike DeWine. And John Husted was out in the hallway and said, no, I don't think that's true. He endorsed you. So they called the governor's office. The governor said he endorsed her. She said, I haven't talked to him in a year, and he's not a part of this campaign. And DeWine, and then when she said she wouldn't support DeWine last week, they called her a Democrat.
Okay.
So that, the DeWine campaign called her, siding with the Democrats, because she wouldn't support DeWine.
Okay.
It's like, well, don't.
I guess if you're a Republican, that's the worst thing you can be called is a Democrat.
or get the governor won 86 of 88 counties in his last election, and neither one of them won his endorsement. They're fighting over who doesn't get it.
Right. Well, that shows the enduring power of the Trump voter, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yes, and especially in a primary, because they're more likely to come out, and primaries always attract the most opinionated, the most partisan within the party. So that's who they're playing to. They probably don't have a lot of choice on that.
Final question here, with about a minute and a half to go. The new tax deal, good or bad?
The new tax deal?
The new...
Not talking about the budget.
Yeah, budget.
The budget?
Yeah, the budget.
The budget has a lot of very good spending in it that is needed, but coming on the heels of the tax bill, it really does blow the roof off of the deficit, and it makes it very difficult to come up with money for anything else, and I'm afraid the Republicans will then decide they have to come after our Social Security and our Medicare and our Medicaid and our social programs. That's the danger.
And they still want to indict Hillary Clinton.
Right. Exactly.
Boy, I tell you, they won't.
Pathetic.
Well, I don't know. Eleanor Clifton, it's always a lot of fun, and I hope we can talk again soon. And best of luck. I'll be watching the McLaughlin group.
Okay, thanks so much. All right.
Bye-bye. We'll be back momentarily here with another guest. Don't go away.
Because it's honest, and you're going to do a lot of laughing. And the only reason I wrote the book